First of all, welcome to you. I'm Rosemary Elabash. I'm the Alabama State Director. This is the first time we have ever done a virtual small business day. And Alan McBride, one of our leadership council members, said we should have just termed it the small business hour. So that way we know how long people are going to be on the phone. So we are delighted to have you with us this morning. We also want to thank our sponsors. Alabama Power Company and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alabama have been really wonderful sponsors for NFIB over many, many years, and they are a great partner to have with us, and they're all over the state, and they always reach out a helping hand with whatever we need to do. The other thing I want to recognize today is our wonderful Leadership Council. We have a very active Leadership Council in Alabama. All across the board, geographically, types of business, gender, everything that that you need to have a robust leadership council, and we do, and we thank them for their service and for what they do every single day. We also have a brief welcome from Brad Close, who's the NFIB president and CEO. Of course, he can't travel right now, but he wanted to introduce himself and do a short video of welcome to our Small Business Hour today.
Welcome to our Small Business Day. Thank you so much for taking time away from your business to attend, and thank you for your membership in NFIB. We know that running your business takes most of your time and effort, and we very much appreciate that you're willing to spend some of your precious time here today with us. You play a very important role in our small business days. Meetings between legislators and small business owners are a crucial part of our efforts. Most legislators don't own a business, and they don't know the first thing about how to run one, what goes into hiring employees, making payroll, and paying taxes, not to mention what goes into dealing with OSHA, EPA, and the IRS. This is your time to tell your story. Make sure that they understand that the legislation they're considering, how it really impacts your business, and what they should be doing as legislators to help small businesses create jobs and boost their economy. Our state programs have always been a key strength here at NFIB, and it's one of the things that really sets us apart from other organizations. This was all the more important in 2020, as big decisions were made by state governments all across the country that impacted small businesses, their employees, and their communities. You have the opportunity here to educate legislators about running a small business and what it actually takes to create jobs. If you aren't able to share your thoughts during the meeting, I hope that you take the time to call or write your legislators. Thank you for your time, thank you for your activism, and thank you for your membership in NFIB. Enjoy the day.
Thank you. Also, we had asked that if you're an NFIB member, that you could ask non-members to join us today for our Small Business Hour, and I'm going to use that term. So there is an easy way to join, and if there's a problem with that, please contact Hunter or myself, and we're happy to walk you through that. I do want to go ahead and introduce Congressman Gary Palmer. Congressman Palmer is a native Alabamian. He's from Hackleburg, Alabama, went to the University of Alabama, and he worked in the private sector for several years, but he started Alabama Policy Institute. That's where I first met Congressman Palmer. And this institute has become one of the premier in the nation for doing research on issues. Congressman Palmer, before he was elected to Congress, served on several boards throughout. He was appointed by governors to several different types of boards. But in 2014, he was elected to Congress, and he has been a very active member of Congress. His focus has been paying down the national debt, cutting regulatory reform, and reducing federal regulations. And we don't even need to talk about how onerous that is for small business owners. He is currently serving on the Energy and Commerce Committee. He chairs the Republican Policy Committee, and he's a member of the Republican Study Committee. He and his wife, Ann, live in Hoover, and they have three adult children. And I'm so pleased to welcome Congressman Palmer to NFIB Small Business Hour today. Ethan, have you got him on? Ethan.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, good. It helps to unmute. Well, thanks, Rosemary. I have to say that Rosemary and I have worked together for a long time, and you really have a champion leading NFIB in Alabama. In terms of briefly some of the things that you mentioned that I'm working on, obviously paying down the federal debt has become a much bigger task, and I'm hoping that at some point we can work with the administration and the Democrats. It may be a fool's errand in this regard to try to stop some of the massive spending. I'm honestly not optimistic, but we're going to continue to work on that. We were doing some really great things with the Trump administration on regulatory reform. I chaired the subcommittee on intergovernmental affairs on the oversight committee, and I really believe that was the work that we started out with at the very beginning of the Trump administration on regulatory reform that jump-started the economy. And we're going to be very vigilant in trying to prevent a return of overly restrictive regulations that really don't do anything other than hamstring the economy, and to try to get us through the next 2 to 4 years. I am, this is probably not a political call, but I am optimistic that we will get the majority back in 2022 and be able to put forward some more policies that I think will be good for the economy and good for the country. Rosemary, I don't know if you want any more than that, but I'll be happy to ask questions after everybody else has their chance to say something.
What I do want to focus on, and because I continue to get complaints, and we do have people of, I will say if you do want to ask a question, there is something at the top of your screen that allows you to raise your hand, or you can certainly email or unmute yourself by pressing *6 on your phone and then unmute on the screen. But Congressman Palmer, I continue to get requests about unemployment fraud. And you and I have talked about this in the past. And if you would give us some overview on where you think we are, what people need, what businesses need to be doing, what they need to do to protect themselves, because this is becoming almost a daily occurrence on calls to my office here.
Well, we first started working on this back in May of last year. Working with the Secret Service and with the U.S. Department of Labor, their Office of Inspector General, and local law enforcement here in Alabama. And it was by the end of May, we had determined that the state of Washington had sent out over $1 billion in fraudulent payments, and that 25% of everything Mississippi sent out was fraud. It's going to be in the billions, tens of billions of dollars that has gone out fraudulently. The investigations are ongoing. We know that there's a crime ring out of Nigeria that got access to people's personal identification information to file these fraudulent claims. There's a crime ring out of Atlanta. There was an arrest about a month ago of a lady in Dothan who was operating out of a travel trailer who had defrauded the state of Alabama of $1 million. That gives you an idea of the scope of this. There's a number of concerns here. Senator John Thune and I introduced legislation in the last Congress to force the states to restore the safeguards that they had. And just some simple things like, denying claims from foreign IP addresses. We were trying to get those in. Tried to work them in this last stimulus package, and we were unsuccessful. We did get a couple of things in the stimulus package passed back in December. But the things that you ought to be telling your employees to look out for, and one of my big concerns is that they're going to get some 1099-Gs if they haven't already, claiming that they owe income tax to the state of Alabama and the federal government on unemployment benefits they never received. And in the last stimulus bill, that bill exempts just under $11,000 in unemployment income, but some of these claims are going to be substantially higher. And I'm concerned it's going to be a nightmare for people when they get their income tax returns to prove that they did not receive unemployment benefits.
Another issue that has come up is the infrastructure bill. And we keep reading just press reports about what they're going to do and how the money's going to be spent, that a lot of it's going to be focused on green, new platforms. So do you have some insight, and particularly how that would affect Alabama when you're looking at the port and interstate, and whether we get 84 four-laned across Congressman Moore's district down there along with Congressman Carl's?
Well, Rosemary, as you know, I was on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee in the last Congress. I just moved up to Energy and Commerce, which I think is considered the most influential committee in Congress, has the broadest jurisdiction. So some of the infrastructure debate will take place in the Energy and Commerce Committee. But in the last Congress, we had an infrastructure bill that the Democrats brought to committee with zero Republican input. And I've never known that to happen in all the years that I worked with the think tank in my short duration in Congress. I'd never seen that happen. It was always bipartisan. So that bill came out of committee with no Republican votes. And it was about just under $600 billion and was sent to the Rules Committee, where another $1 trillion was added to it. It was a 1.6 in that range trillion-dollar infrastructure bill, and it got zero votes from Republicans and was not taken up in the Senate. I anticipate the same thing this time, Rosemary, and I hate to say that, because not only do we need to address the Port of Mobile, the Bay Bridge, U.S. Highway 84, we need to, in Barry's district, we need to be looking at an I-10 connector. We need to be making major improvements to I-565 and U.S. Highway 72 going west from Huntsville. We need the Northern Beltline in Birmingham. And there are plans for a new interstate, I-14, that will connect military bases starting in Texas, going all the way to the Gulf Coast, to the Atlantic coast of Georgia. All of that is hanging out there along with broadband. But my concern is that this bill will be brought to the Transportation Infrastructure Committee and to the Energy and Commerce Committee with no Republican input. And it will basically be AOC's Green New Deal, which, even though Alabama has these great needs, I don't think we can go for that. Looking at what they want to do will have devastating consequences for our economy. We might be trading a vote to get a new highway or a bridge, but what we would get in exchange would not justify what we might get in infrastructure.
So when they talk about the Green New Deal, are we talking about the new, going back to the puddle rule or Endangered Species Act or things like rattlesnakes, or
no.
What are we looking at?
No, what we're looking at is a major shutdown of fossil fuels and a significant increase in energy costs. And this is for a state with its household income at the level that we have, it will really be burdensome. lower income people already pay a disproportionate amount of their disposable income for household energy. And energy costs is the most inflationary part of the economy. The cost of energy is compounded throughout the economy. It starts with the harvesting of a product or the extraction of the minerals to the refinement, to the production of metal or wood or food, to the packaging. I mean, all the way up transportation, warehousing, the delivery to the point of sale. And the point of sale, and that's where they're leading us. I think that they would love to get us to a $5 or $6 a gallon cost for gasoline. You look at what Massachusetts is an example of how stupid this is. They refuse to buy U.S. natural gas produced in the Marcellus Shale. This is right there in the region. They won't allow the pipelines to come in. Yet they bought gas from Russia, some of which was extracted from the Arctic region where they penetrated the permafrost, where they broke up the ice with icebreakers, and it has 40 to 42% more emissions issues than U.S. gas. It's a much dirtier gas, much more expensive than U.S. gas. That's just beyond dumb. That's stupid. And it's harmful to our economy. You look I've been reading Bill Gates' book, which I think that for a liberal, he is sensible in the context of what we need to do in terms of energy. He's a huge proponent of nuclear. It's the cleanest way to produce electricity. And that's where we need to be going. But that's not what they want to do. He even supports hydro. But they want to completely eliminate fossil fuel. And it's not only going to have a negative impact on our economy, it's going to have a geopolitical impact, because Eastern Europe, those nations in Eastern Europe, do not want to be in the shadow of Russia and be relying on them for their energy resources, particularly natural gas. So they're going to they're really pushing for electric vehicles. You'll see a huge push for the states and municipalities to go all electric and renewables. And there's no way that we can produce the energy capacity that this country needs with renewables. And they think we can get there by 2035. You didn't mention prior to running the think tank that I worked for two international engineering companies, one of which was Combustion Engineering in their Environmental Systems Division. And I can assure you, as great, as smart as we are in engineering and technology, we cannot get to all renewables in 14 years. It's an engineering impossibility.
I see that Glenn Phillips has his hand raised. Hunter?
Sure, go ahead and unmute, Glenn. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, hello, Hackleberg guy from a Bear Creek guy.
Hey, was Phillips High School named after your family?
My great-great-grandfather, John R. Phillips, he'd passed, and my great-great-grandmother donated the land. So I'm the first of a third generation to graduate from that school. So
when did you graduate?
82.
Well, I was so skinny in high school, I couldn't buy a date. And the only girl that went out with me was a blind date from Bear Creek. She probably hadn't recovered from it yet.
Well, we're glad to see Hackleberg rise from the ashes of those tornadoes.
Yeah, that was horrible.
Yeah. So I have so many questions, but here's one, because I agree with you about the engineering issues. I'm an Auburn engineer. You're right on point. It's also, as an entrepreneur, these are entrepreneurial fallacies that you can, the rule of entrepreneurship is when you got a project, a new business, is to figure out how much time and money you think it will require and at least triple them, or you run out of runway and need more capital. But the question I have is a little different, and is that clearly right now there's no bipartisanship. Are there any Democrats at all that you think would shift enough to bring bipartisanship back, or is this just going to be the next 2 years?
I'm afraid it's going to be the next 2 years. There's a number of Democrats that I thought would be with us on some things that haven't. You're starting to see a little bit of a breakaway now over the issue of removing Marionette Miller-Meeks from her seat in Congress. She won her race in Iowa by 6 votes, went through multiple recounts, bipartisan review and recount, and was certified by the state of Iowa. Rather than file a complaint in the Iowa courts, her opponent has brought it to the House Committee on Administration under a law that was passed, I guess, in the 1980s or 70s, I can't remember, that would allow Congress to not accept the certification of a member. And the dumb thing about this is, Glenn, is that she received Pelosi flies a flag over the Capitol for all the members who were elected during while she was Speaker. And they presented Marionette with a flag. I told her she ought to go down on the floor and hold up the flag and say, you know, is this a lie? But there's 7 Democrats that have publicly said they don't support that. So that's a break. On the energy side, there's some Democrats that I think are really in a tight spot. Vicente Gonzalez from Texas, Henry Clayar and Lizzie Fletcher from Texas, Clayar's from San Antonio, Fletcher's from the Houston area. And I don't know if they will stick with this infrastructure plan, this Green New Deal plan, but Lizzie has already demonstrated more of an allegiance to Pelosi than to her district in Texas on some other issues, including the stimulus package. And we've been debating the infrastructure, the energy part of it in a committee. I think I don't know who from my D.C. staff is on this call, but I think we've had at least, I know we've had one hearing, we may have had 2. So is that Elizabeth?
Yes.
Yes, sir, I'm on here.
Okay. So we've gone round and round with them about it. On the Energy and Commerce Committee, I don't know that we're going to get anywhere. Fletcher's on that committee. She's also on transportation infrastructure. And I just don't know. But we're going to work on them. I was hoping we could flip 5 of them and get us in the majority.
Is there any, is the agenda that there's a huge risk that these actions will lead to turning at 2 years or 4 years a complete flip back to Republicans in a knee jerk, but so the goal is to do as much of their agenda, just ram it all down and figure that even if it flips, it can't all be undone?
Well, it can all be undone. One Congress cannot bind another, but it couldn't be undone at least until after the 24 election.
Debt's hard to undo.
Well, the debt part is a huge problem. But in terms of their agenda, undoing a lot of their agenda will help address the debt issue because it will unleash the economy. But we cannot grow ourselves out of the debt burden that we have. This may be getting a little off the beaten path, but this I was on the budget committee for my first 2 terms, and it's something that I spent a tremendous amount of time on is the wasted money. Last year, we sent out $206 billion in improper payments. And we do everything in 10-year windows. That's over $2 trillion plus interest, because when you're operating a deficit, that's $206 billion that we borrowed to send out improperly. And I've been working with the Government Accountability Office and had a very interesting bipartisan discussion. I spent my first three terms in Congress on the Oversight Committee and developed good working relationships with two guys who are hardcore leftists but are reasonable on some things, Jerry Connolly from Virginia and Peter Welch from Vermont. And they're trying to convince Pelosi to put me back on that committee because we want to address the improper payments. And the way I want to go about it is one of the reasons we have so much inefficiency and so much waste in the government is our IT systems are so antiquated. We've got agencies, IT systems that won't communicate with each other or won't communicate with state agencies. So we've come up with a plan to take some of that money that they cut back on the improper payments and roll it into replacing our IT systems to bring them into the 21st century. And Connolly wants to use the balance of the money for deficit reduction. That's a start. One of the reasons I'm so concerned about what Biden's doing on the oil and gas production is that there's a think tank out of New York run by a guy named Daniel Yergin. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he's a brilliant guy. And they project, and there's two or three different studies, but the projection is over the next 10 to 15 years, just on oil exports, we could generate between $1.3 and $2.8 trillion in new revenues. And then we're taking in over $500 billion a year in fines, fees, and court awards that don't show up in the Treasury. They're retained by agencies. Some of it is to offset other spending, but they retain a substantial amount of that. So when we start adding all that up, I figured that over a 10-year period, we could probably save somewhere between in the range of about $6 trillion. And the objective is not to get us completely out of debt because you're always going to have debt. What you want to do is have a debt to GDP ratio that is manageable. So you need to be in that 50-60% range. We're over 100% right now. That means our debt's greater than our entire economy. And that I just nerded out on you, but.
No, I'm a nerd. I love it. I don't love what you're saying, but I love the description. That's very informative. Thank you.
Well, the encouraging part of that ought to be that when we get the majority back in the House and Senate and get a Republican in the White House, the debt issue will be a huge issue, and it was going to be a big issue with the Trump administration's second term. And I did, I worked very closely with his folks, domestic policy advisor is a dear friend of mine. And we were set to deal with this in a second Trump term. So we'll be ready to go after 24.
Congressman Palmer, I want to thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us today. I know you've got a busy day because you've got a very special guest coming to Birmingham today. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. But you know what? When she comes back, I hope I'm available to come.
Well, they've got that forest fire in the Black Hills that they've had to evacuate part of West Rapid City and shut down Mount Rushmore. So she's got her hands full this morning.
She does.
We've got her rescheduled for May 7th.
Okay, great. We may have other questions, and if I do, I will send those directly to you or Ethan or Elizabeth and get those answers back for NFIB members. But thank you again for joining us this morning and for always being available to help small business owners, which you are, and I deeply appreciate that.
My pleasure. I really appreciate all y'all do.
Thank you. Thank you. We're so glad to welcome newly elected Congressman Barry Moore from the 2nd Congressional District, which is my home district, down in the Wiregrass. And Congressman Moore is an NFIB member, not a new member, but a longtime member. He couldn't get away from his salesperson, Kim Weeks, if he wanted to, because she is tenacious. But he has been a very valuable member when he served in the Alabama legislature. He served on the Commerce and Small Business Committee. And his very first term, he sponsored a bill for NFIB. It had to do with one of, his constituents. So it worked out very, very well. But he has been elected in this new Congress. He is from Enterprise. He and his wife, Heather, have 4 children, but he runs a business every day, and I will tell you a funny story. Right after he was elected, I called him, and he said, "Hold on just a minute. I got to get down off the front-end loader." He had gone back to work. He got elected, but he had to go back to work. So he's a real working guy, but in his new role as a member of Congress, he's serving on the Ag Committee and on the Veteran Affairs Committee, and both of those committees are absolutely vital for the 2nd Congressional District. So we are so pleased to have him with us today, and Congressman Moore, tell us a little bit about being a new member of Congress.
Well, thank you, Rosemary. Thank you so much for having me. And I, you know, Kim Weeks, I actually took her to her prom. So every time she comes calling on membership dues, I mean, what can I say, right? I got to write a check. But
She
lives down the road from my office. And she's tenacious, like you said. So at any rate, yeah. So the first 90 days, I don't want to take any of the credit or any of the blame. We've been playing defense pretty well, as best we can. And I think Congressman Palmer hit on some very, it made me feel better to hear him say that. I kind of felt the same way. I think we'll get the majority in 2022. But right now, even with the COVID relief packages and the bills that have been going through, we haven't had a lot of voice in the process. The amendments, they don't allow Republicans to bring many amendments. And so there are some concerns, obviously, with the infrastructure bill that they're talking about, another $3 trillion in addition to our debt. And just some background, we spent more already on COVID relief. We spent, in today's dollars, I think $5.8 trillion. And to put that in perspective, we spent about $4.4 or $4.5 on World War II. So we have printed a lot of money in the last 10 months. And so, obviously, I think there's going to be some inflationary issues going forward for our economy. They're talking about, from a small business standpoint, Rosemary, and I was on a call with the Ag Secretary this morning, if they're looking at this estate tax, we need to make sure that our small business owners understand, because the inflationary process with the money that's been printed, and if you're sitting there with a term life policy to kind of retire your debt, you know, if something happens to your business to pass along to your family, we may need to adjust those policies a little. I know our insurance salesmen are probably happy to hear that, but we're going to have to adjust for those inflationary dollars. And I don't know this inflation right now. You know, building prices are up pretty high, what we're seeing. Materials are really high. I think some of that's because of COVID. A lot of the factories shut down. They're starting production now again. Of course, we thought the economy might slow, and then Lowe's and Walmart and some of those guys had heydays, but all our small businesses kind of suffered. So it's not very fair how well our government to pick winners and losers. I didn't appreciate that a bit. And so, but going forward, I think that we're going to see some inflationary issues. And so as small business owners, we got to do a really good job of planning how we phase out, or if there's a especially if they raise this estate tax. And they're looking to repeal the Tax Cuts, Jobs Act that Trump brought through. So there are some issues going forward. We've got our plate full. So some things I'm concerned about. I do feel like I said, we'll get the majority. And maybe not everybody's as conservative as I am all the time, but we just need to get the gavel away from Nancy, guys. We need to flip 5 and make sure that Nancy, because what she's doing right now is really not, you know, Ronald Reagan always said it, Rosemary, and you've heard me say this, the government's idea on the economy, if it's moving, you tax it. If it keeps moving, you regulate it. If it fails, you subsidize it. So my plan is, hey, let's cut the taxes and regulations. Free markets will fix a lot of our problems. And there is a concern with the debt, obviously, but we just need to get government taxes and regulations out of the way. Let us guys, the small business owners, do what we're pretty good at doing.
You know, one of the issues, and you brought this up, is this term non-essential and essential businesses. And I just cannot tell you the harm that was done to businesses during the shutdown. And I continue to hear from them. They are using their PPP money, their EIDL loan money. And, you know, the thing is, this is not extra money. This is money for them to actually survive and be able to keep their doors open. So that kind of money has been beneficial to help keep small towns alive. And, you know, you look around, Congressman Palmer now lives in Birmingham, and you live in Enterprise, which is actually the largest city between Montgomery and Dothan. But everything around you in the other part of your district is very small, and they were already struggling. so when you put that term in there, it's created a very uneven playing field. And there actually is a bill in the Alabama legislature that will do away with that term. And we are looking hopeful that that is going to pass. But, you know, the challenge, as you remember, is always getting on the special order calendar. And that's where that bill is today. But as we think about going forward in any other relief as far as taxes, and you brought up the estate tax, that one's going to be vital, that we pass a permanent repeal of the estate tax. And Alabama is a state that would definitely benefit from that, because people's IRA are the trees, and it's their land. That's where their retirement is. So that bill, thank you for bringing that up, because that is absolutely vital. I would like to go back to your service on the Veterans Committee, because with you having bases in your district, can you give us any kind of insight on what you see as far as keeping the bases open, the tug between the Huntsville area and keeping that alive on where it was supposed to be? Do you have any kind of insight on that that you could share with us?
Well, you know, I think, Rosemary, if you remember, in my time in the legislature, we carried a lot of legislation to make sure that we protected Alabama against BRAC. So there was the small business, you know, the licensee transfer, reciprocity for spouses moving over, and in-state tuition. I'm carrying a bill now at the federal level to help our guardsmen who are deployed. But, you know, it's one of those things. I think we have to work closely with the state legislature to make sure that Alabama is as military-friendly as we can be. And I think we've done a fine job in the years past. We just need to continue to pursue that. I feel like I've been out to Fort Rucker. I toured a few weeks ago. I'm bringing Congressman Natterholt down on the 8th. I'm going to take him out. He requested to come down and do a visit. So I've met with the commanding generals out there. I think the mission for Fort Rucker is pretty secure. We obviously need to work in some areas in education and around the Montgomery area to make sure Maxwell guns are secure. But I think it's key for the legislation, the state itself, to sell itself to the veterans, the families, and the active duty to make sure that they know that Alabama is military friendly. We want to continue to pursue that. Obviously, you know, I've got a lot of ties to the military, and growing up here at Fort Rucker was a big part of my upbringing. And so my brother retired, and my son-in-law's an Army Ranger. So we have a lot of ties to understand that family, the value to the family, having a good education base, but also having some education-friendly policies like in-state tuition, those sort of things. And so that stuff we push through at the state level, but we continue to work closely with the state legislature to make sure that they know that, hey, we want Alabama to always be at the bottom of the BRAC list. We want to make sure we don't get at the top and we don't lose a base in any form or fashion. And we've got land, labor, and climate that's pretty conducive, I think, to continue to train military here. And the mission at Rucker seems to be in good shape based on what the general and what deputy director is telling me out there this past week. And we continue to increase our aircraft capabilities and the training. I flew a simulator last week, and it's amazing now that the private sector that's come on to help train our soldiers in some of those capacities. So we'll continue to do what we can. I think it's key just making sure that they know on a federal level that we want to recruit, just like the Red Tails. You know, we had to pass 7 bills to get through that package to bring the Red Tails to Alabama. And I think as long as we work together, we're pretty secure.
Also, would you talk about Enterprise landing the new veterans nursing home? That is such an economic boom for that area, not just for Enterprise, for all the surrounding towns that will provide a workforce for that.
Yeah, it was a great, you know, it was very competitive, obviously, when they narrowed it down to this part of the state needed one. We didn't have one in this area, and so it was very competitive. But I think the key to that was we had some people on board that were helping, that had government contracted before, that were in the private sector, were willing to volunteer their time to write an RFP or a proposal to say, hey, to recruit that VA down to this area. And so, you know, it seems to me that it was really a great team effort, and we got some land donated, that sort of thing. So we're excited to have it. We're really pleased. I toured the VA last week in Montgomery, but to have a retirement center here, it's going to be a great job, economic engine for us, and we've got some other things coming to the area. So we're excited to have it. And I think, again, it was just teamwork. You know, it was the community came together, and it was competitive. I mean, all the cities around were competing for it. Enterprise was just fortunate to land it.
Well, the good thing about that, it is such a economic boom for small business owners, because when you get a facility like that, then you're going to have new suppliers, you're going to have new restaurants, you're going to have, you know, more cars sold, more houses built. I mean, it truly is an economic boom when you are able to attract that type of facility to an area, especially a rural area, which is key, is absolutely key.
We're very excited. We're very excited. Like I said, we have so many veterans, too, because Fort Rucker, a lot of people would leave and come back because, you know, it was a lot of where they learned to fly, then they come back and they're IPs here after the fact when they're in private sector and civilian service, and then they retire here. So to have that retirement center here is really a blessing for our community.
Before you finish your talk, is there anyone that has a question for Congressman Moore? You'll raise your hand, and if not, I do have a raised hand. I don't know who that is, Hunter.
It's Rhonda. Go ahead, Rhonda. If you could unmute yourself in the top right and go ahead and ask your question.
Am I muted?
No, you're good.
Good morning, Congressman, and thank you so much for all you're doing for our area. Also, Mary, it's wonderful to have founders to encourage us that are here on the bottom. I have a couple of questions about real. Since we're located in North Alabama, we've got a strong agriculture, but the tax they are speaking of that could be owned that have to, and also many of them are estate passed on from generation to generation. The way that I understand it, not only this death tax when you get the property things, like if you have a small business and you have a customer list, that they have decided they can actually value on that. I support all the veterans. Thank you for all of my members suffered. But as a small business, particularly in our business, that are coming at us are more than we can deal with. We're in the HVAC business, the energy stipulations that they're putting in the, we're facing shortages of equipment, pressure of online purchases from wherever they are, and then the licenses that they require me. I know that's a lot, and any of it that you would like to we would thank you for.
Hey, Rosemary, did you hear that clearly? I heard some of the questions, but it was breaking up. Did you pick up?
It was in and out. I know she referred to the estate tax and the shortage that they are having in acquiring equipment and parts. They're in the heating and air conditioning business, and a part of that may be COVID, but I suspect part of that also are all these environmental concerns where they keep changing the parts that you may need or increasing heating and air conditioning. So a lot of that, I would suspect, is EPA-related on those rules and regulations.
Yeah, and maybe, a friend of mine runs Scott's Lumber Company down in the south part of the state near Mobile, and he was telling me that now I can't speak to the HVAC because I haven't talked specifically to the manufacturing sector there, but from his standpoint, now I think they do mostly plywood. It was just they laid a lot. The COVID, they kind of shut the factories down, expecting the demand to decrease, obviously. And so they cleared their warehouse out because the demand, everybody, like we were talking about earlier, was going to Lowe's with the honeydew list. And so all the plywood kind of got it out of the inventory. All their resources got pulled out and put on the honeydew list or whatever the case may be. Now, he told me last week they were at 68% production. They've kind of, they rolled back in. It brought people back in. They've been pretty, I guess they had to be methodical how they brought people in because of COVID. So I would imagine that we're seeing that in the industry-wide in construction especially, is just they're having to ramp production back up. But that still doesn't necessarily explain the appraisals and prices that we're seeing on property right now. Some of these houses, what they're going for. And what's really strange to me is the bonuses. I mean, if you bid on a house right now, guys, and I don't know if y'all have been following, but it's asking price plus $5,000 in my part of the world. So they don't even negotiate. Like, you'll have multiple buyers. And so I can't explain that part of it, but I think that a lot of the supply right now is the issue on just the basic getting the materials out and getting production back up. So that's one of the things. What was the other question, Rosemary?
I believe it had to do with, you know, the changing equipment and all the environmental concerns, particularly that heating and air conditioning people have to adapt with every single day. And that's a regulatory agency. And I see Congressman Palmer has raised his hand. So you're the engineer. Fill us in on that.
Well, on the material side, Barry's comment about the production at the mills, the plywood and the lumber, is that timber prices are very low. Lumber prices are high because the mills can't keep up with the demand. And Barry made a point there about, did you say at Scotch Lumber they're only at 68% capacity? These prices are going to stay high until these mills can get back to full production. On some of the other things that you're dealing with, and I think it'll impact HVAC systems, is the shortage of components. It's impacting automobile manufacturing. It's also impacting appliance manufacturing because they don't have the microchips and some of the other components that they need. So this goes back to some of the issues that we've been dealing with about supply chain. And the arguments that we were making during the Trump administration last year, really, because of what we're learning from COVID, is the need to move that stuff back to the United States or closer to the United States. And I've got some ideas that I'm going to be pushing on for helping Central American nations get a more reliable power grid, because we need to be we're in competition with China. And a lot of people don't realize this in South America and Central America. It's all over the world. So we need to take a page out of what they're doing and create new markets for ourselves by helping some of these countries, which will also help us with our immigration issue.
Absolutely. All right. Go ahead, Congressman Moore.
Hey, Rosemary. I've got another one that's Zoom that started at 10. I'm late for it.
Oh, okay.
And let me say, too, thank you all. And Gary, we're fortunate to have you from the Alabama delegation, y'all. He heads up policy, does a fantastic job. And so we're glad to have him on board. He's kind of helping me along, understand some of the process, and it's very complex. But thank you so much. But I just want to let you know I got to get on this other call here. And so, but
thank you.
Again, I appreciate what the NFIB does, and if I can ever be of assistance, y'all don't hesitate to let me know.
All right.
Well,
thank you.
We're fortunate to have another businessman in our delegation with Barry, not to just exchange one compliment for another, but Barry's going to do a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Our final speaker today is an NFIB person. Mitch joined our staff from Congressman Byrne's staff, and he's a native Alabamian, graduated from college here in Alabama, and we were so pleased when he decided to join NFIB. So, Mitch, if you want to give us an overview on where you are and where we think NFIB is and what members can do to help give our message to our elected officials.
Well, absolutely, Rosemary, and thank you so much. And I'll do my best to keep this a small business hour. It's really great to be with everybody. As Rosemary said, you know, I worked for Bradley Byrne for a number of years and Spencer Backus before that. So, you know, while I live in D.C., I'm an Alabamian. My family's still there, and it's always going to be home. But, you know, first and foremost, what you guys do for our organization is really everything. And I think that the greatest part about NFIB is when I come in to meet with a member of Congress or their staff, you know, they really know that we have our members behind us and that we speak for them and that we only care about their interests. And I think that is what makes NFIB so successful. So, you know, really highly encourage you to participate in the process. I'm going to put out just our general federal email address. You know, if you ever have an issue, a federal issue that you need help on, or you have a question on, or you think we need to know about, please email us and let us know, because it really is how we generate so much that we take to the Hill on your behalf. And the other thing I just want to say is on our action alerts. When you see those, please fill those out, and please send them in, and please customize them if you can. If you see there's an issue before Congress, whether it's minimum wage or state tax, and you have a good story to tell, that is so helpful, because, you know, it goes on to your member of Congress, and they hear from you, but we can also see it too. And a lot of times somebody on our team might call you and say, hey, would you be willing to, you know, maybe do more? And recently we've had members who have testified before committees. Because anytime people from the Hill come to us and they say, well, we try to get NFIB members on the Hill talking about real world small business issues. Because like, you know, everyone else has said, it's so important for members of Congress and their staff to hear, you know, what small business needs are. But, you know, I just real quickly, you know, kind of talk about the end of last year. You know, it seems like a million years ago, but it was a presidential election year. And unfortunately, like most years in Washington, that really slowed things down a lot. And then all of a sudden in December, things started moving again very, very quickly. And negotiations between Congress and President Trump really picked up over additional COVID relief. NFIB outlined four priorities that we felt that needed to be accomplished for our nation's small business. And that was the first was a targeted second round PPP loan for severely impacted businesses. The second was reversing the IRS's decision on the deductibility of PPP forgiven expenses. The third was streamlining the PPP forgiveness process for small businesses. And the final one was improving the interaction between PPP and other COVID relief programs. And that's preventing the idle advance grant from counting against PPP forgiveness, allowing companies who took PPP to also receive the employee retention tax credit. And, you know, after, you know, a lot of work from our members and good lobbying, we were fortunate to see all of that included in the final end of the year COVID and appropriations package that President Trump signed. So, you know, if you have any questions about that, please let us know. I'm going to put in here in the chat box a real brief overview of the second draw PPP loan. If you still have questions about that, Congress just extended the deadline for PPP through May 31st. So highly encourage everyone to take a look at a second draw loan. If you're thinking about it, see if you qualify. I'm also going to put in some information on the employee retention tax credit, which is another really, really great opportunity, that we really encourage our members to take a look at, because originally, if you receive PPP, you couldn't receive the employee retention tax credit. That's now changed. It is a really great opportunity. So, you know, just talking about where we're going, moving forward, you know, obviously in January, change in control in the presidency, change in control of the Senate really changed the landscape in Washington. You know, the Democratic majority is a very, very slim majority in both the House and the Senate. But, you know, with a majority comes the really powerful tool of budget reconciliation. So, you know, we talk all the time about the filibuster in the Senate, how it takes 60 votes to do things. Well, with the budget reconciliation process, you can pass things on a simple majority if they're related to the federal budget. And the original idea was you could pass policies that would bring federal policy in line with the budget process. And really, majorities, Republican and Democratic majorities, have used that process to really enact, you know, some of their policies. And, you know, we were seeing that now with this Democratic-controlled Congress and Democrat president. And so the first use of that was the American Rescue Plan, which passed earlier, was last month, the beginning of this month. I think it was the beginning of this month. And, you know, so we had some serious concerns there. NFIB key voted against the bill in the House because it included a provision to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. And that was an increase in the federal minimum wage immediately of more than 30%, and then a phase in over 4 years to $15. And after achieving $15, it was an automatic annual, it was automatic annual increase based on inflation. It also eliminated the federal tip minimum wage. So that bill, it came, the rescue plan came out of the House with the minimum wage piece attached. Fortunately, the Senate parliamentarian ruled that that was outside of the budget process. It didn't comply with budget reconciliation. So that, that was stripped to the Senate. However, Senator Sanders tried to add that back in as an amendment. And NFIB again key voted against that. And we were really fortunate. We had a good, very bipartisan majority vote against that. It was 58 no's, 42 yeses. So a lot of hard work by NFIB. And we feel pretty good where we're at on the minimum wage with that. You know, obviously, you know, but we don't know. And the thing about the Senate is, you know, for so many years, we've gotten very comfortable saying, oh, well, you know, that proposal could never get 60 votes in the Senate. But really, you know, the Senate is in charge of their own rules. And, you know, at any time the Democrat majority were to move to eliminate the filibuster, you know, they could really do that. There aren't, you know, the courts aren't, are very unlikely to step in and try to, you know, enforce the Senate's own rules. So, you know, we, I think, you know, from our perspective at the federal lobbying team, we really have to always be, you know, concerned that we're really firing with live ammunition and, you know, things could change. But, you know, after the minimum wage was removed, NFIB also key voted another amendment by Senator Portman to decrease the federal UI bonus, which President Biden was trying to increase back up to $400 per week. The amendment kept it at $300 per week and sunsetted it. You know, that amendment passed. Unfortunately, the Democrats were then able to come in and add an additional amendment to the legislation, which increased that federal unemployment bonus through September 6th. So that's another issue. Obviously, I know we've heard from a lot of folks that that there's a lot of concern about finding employees, that people are staying on unemployment, that just the unemployment system is a mess. So, you know, we're going to keep really fighting hard to see that not extended past September. But, yeah, we'll keep you guys updated on that. But on, you know, on top of that, there were some good things in the bill. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the employee retention tax credit was further extended, which we were pleased to see. There was a provision containing $25 billion in grants for restaurants. So that if you own a restaurant, you might want to look into that grant program. There's some really great information on NFIB's website. We've had some webinars on that as well. So definitely encourage you to take a look at that. And the bill also extended the tax credit for employee leave for COVID-related reasons. So if you have an employee that has to take leave because of COVID, there is a federal tax credit for that purpose. But it extended that credit without the mandate that was previously in the bill from the end of the Trump administration. So we were glad to see the optional tax credit remained without the mandate. You know, looking at some other things that are going on, obviously this administration is very pro labor union. They haven't hidden that. They've been very upfront about that. So I think that's going to be something NFIB is going to really have to watch out for. On March 9th, the House passed the PRO Act, which is really a very radical union focused piece of legislation. And just to talk about some of the provisions in the PRO Act. It allows unions to participate in secondary boycotts throughout the supply chain. It imports California's ABC independent contractor test nationwide. And this is really the most stringent test for if somebody qualifies as an independent contractor. And it also removes right to work laws in every state, including Alabama. So obviously this is a really big deal. NFIB key voted against that in the House. We're watching that in the Senate. We know that there aren't 60 votes for that bill, but you know, if something changes on the filibuster, you know, this could be a real live issue. So definitely encourage everyone to continue to monitor that issue, to fill out an action alert on the PRO Act if you haven't already, because it's a big deal. You know, finally on the labor front, I'd say we're really watching what the Department of Labor is going to do regarding a potential emergency temporary standard related to COVID-19. And with an ETS or an emergency temporary standard, the Department of Labor in situations where there's a grave danger could implement new standards that all employers would have to meet related to COVID-19, and that could be very broad. And they don't have to have the typical OSHA notice and comment period. They can publish it in the Federal Register, and then all of a sudden it's right after that, it's essentially it's live, and you have to meet that standard. So we've been pushing back against that. This is something the Trump administration declined to do. We think for good reason. So we're monitoring that issue, but we think that could be coming up very soon. And finally, I'll say, you know, the big thing that we see on the horizon in the next couple of months through the summer is infrastructure, as Congressman Palmer talked about. You know, we're really watching the package because, you know, I think there is going to be physical infrastructure, but they're also talking about a human infrastructure piece of the package. And that's things that they define as increasing the caregiver economy, universal community college, preschool, you know, things like that, things that are really, you know, not related to your typical bridge, road infrastructure on top of the, you know, Green New Deal policies that Congressman Palmer talked about. You know, really, we've seen quotes from the White House that they're calling this the next great society. You know, we've seen price tags up to $4 trillion. And obviously, at some point, you have to pay for that, and it gets it's very concerning to NFIB because there have been some proposals floated that we could see up to $3 trillion in new tax increases. And again, this is one of those bills that can use the reconciliation process because it relates to the federal deficit and the debt. So you could see provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that are very important to small businesses, such as the 199A small business deduction rolled back. You can see probably see individual rates go up, lowering the estate tax threshold, eliminate stepped up in basis for estate tax. Those are all things that we're watching, we're really concerned about. We're going to need your support as, you know, our membership to help us fight back against that. So, you know, right now the infrastructure package is really in its infancy. So we're working hard to educate members of Congress on both sides of the aisle about, you know, the tax needs of small businesses. And really there's a huge gap in knowledge and understanding on how, you know, pass-through entities work, how small businesses file their taxes. So we're working on that. We also were pleased to see that the Death Tax Repeal Act was introduced on a bipartisan basis in the House by Representative Jason Smith and Sanford Bishop, and Senator Thune in the Senate. And Henry Cuellar and Jason Smith have also recently introduced a provision to make the 199A small business deduction permanent. So please encourage everyone to sign on to that bill. It's so important. And again, I know I'm 3 minutes over, but thank you all for everything you do. Like I said, it's so important, and we can't do our job without you guys. So thank you. If anyone wants to ask any questions, I'm happy to answer anything.
Mitch, thank you. And again, thank you to Congressman Palmer and to Congressman Moore for joining us today. If we are having our second Small Business Hour tomorrow, and these will be state officials, beginning with Lieutenant Governor Will Ainsworth, and we will have 5 speakers tomorrow, 10 minutes each, so it will move very quickly. Please think about your questions that you can ask your local legislators. Again, if you are not a member and you were able to join us today, it's very easy to join. We depend on our members. NFIB is a one-member, one-vote organization, and we are just the people that give your message to elected officials on a federal and the state level. So it's our pleasure to do that. Again, we want to thank our sponsors today, Alabama Power and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alabama, and we look forward to having you join us again tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and have a great day. Thank you.